Okay, great. I'd first like to thank the organizers for putting together such a wonderful meeting. So the work that I'm going to be talking about today is a collaborative effort that was led by two very talented PhD students and postdocs, so Patrick Sadler and Matthew Golub, who were co-advised with Professors Aaron Battista, Steve Chase, and me. Okay. So when you hear the term brain-computer interface, the first thing you probably think of is a person controlling a robotic limb with their thoughts. Okay. So this use of brain-computer interfaces has great potential to help paralyzed people. But there's a use of brain-computer interfaces that has not received a ton of attention, and this is using brain-computer interfaces as a tool to understand the brain. Okay, so an overarching message in today's talk is that brain-computer interfaces represents a powerful tool by which we can study mechanisms of the brain. Okay, and why is that? Okay, well, a brain-computer interface simplifies the output interface of the brain without hopefully simplifying the complexities of brain processing that we seek to understand. Okay, so what do I mean by this? Okay, so let's first consider arm reaching. Okay, so here the effector is the arm. Okay, the number of non-output neurons in the brain is many millions, right? These are all the neurons in your brain. The number of output neurons are many thousands, right? These are neurons that project down the spinal cord, right? And in any given experiment, typically only a small fraction of these are recorded at any given time. Oops. Furthermore, the mapping between neural activity and movement is typically unknown. Okay? The effector dynamics are typically difficult to measure and nonlinear. Okay? So I'm talking about the limb with the different joints and also muscle dynamics, which are nonlinear. And also sensory feedback, in particular proprioceptive feedback, here is tied to the arm. Okay, so what we propose, okay, is to use a brain-computer interface to simplify matters. Okay, so a brain-computer interface is described by the following. Okay, so we record the activity of a bunch of neurons, and then we pass the neural activity through a so-called BCI mapping to convert the neural activity into movements of a cursor, computer cursor. Okay, so a BCI mapping is defined or can be defined by the following equation. Okay, so x sub t here is a 2 by 1 vector. That is the velocity of the cursor in the horizontal direction and the vertical direction. Xt minus 1 is the velocity at the previous time step. So A is a 2 by 2 matrix. Okay. Ut here is the neural activity. Okay. So if you're recording from 100 neurons, u would be a 100 by 1 vector, where each element is the spike count of each one of those neurons. And so B here is a matrix that's 2 by 100. Okay? And then little b here is a 2 by 1 vector that's a constant offset. Okay. So while a user is controlling a computer cursor using its neural activity, it gets moment by moment visual feedback. Okay. So in the BCI setup, okay, the effector is no longer the arm, okay, but it's this computer cursor or robotic limb. The number of non-output neurons is still in the many millions, right? But the number of output neurons are, by definition, the neurons that we record, right? And this is typically tens to hundreds. Okay. So a critical aspect of this is that we get to record the full set of output signals here, right? By the way in which we've set up the system. Okay, and so this is going to be extremely powerful because this is going to allow us to make causal statements, okay, about the relationship between neural activity and movement. Okay, So furthermore, the neuron to movement mapping is known, right? That was the equation that I showed on the previous slide. And we as experimenters get to define that. Okay, and then the effector dynamics here, also defined by that same equation, are known, and we can define that to be linear, as shown in that equation. Okay, and then sensory feedback here, in particular proprioceptive feedback, is no longer tied to the effector, right? Because the arm movements are not needed here for BCI control, right? And so one can design an experiment where one passively moves the arm to change the proprioceptive feedback while the subject is controlling a computer cursor. Okay, so people have done experiments to study the use of proprioceptive feedback in that way. Okay, so I want to show you a video of a monkey controlling a computer cursor using the activity of about 50 neurons recorded in the motor cortex. Yeah?
So when you say you record 50 neurons, what do you record exactly? You do spike sorting?
Yep, spike trains.
But you do spike sorting?
Yeah, so you can do it with or without. Okay, so the majority of the results I'm going to show today do not use spike sorting. But if you use spike sorting, you get similar performance. Okay, so I'm going to play a video for you. Okay, and this is a video that's representative of state-of-the-art cursor control, okay, by a monkey when we're recording the activity of around 50 neurons. Okay, so the monkey is controlling this green dot. Okay, and it hits the blue targets to get a juice reward. So these movements are typically around 100% correct with about 1 second movement times. Okay, and so by most metrics, this is about half as good as what you can do with your arm. Okay, so the reason why I want to show you this video is because if we're going to be doing scientific studies with a brain-computer interface, we have to have good behavioral control. Okay, and I hope this video demonstrates to you that we do have that. Yeah, so we get to define the mapping, right, between the neural activity and these cursor movements. And we have a short 2-minute calibration session at the beginning where we record the neural activity while the animal is thinking about moving. Okay, and using that neural activity, we train the parameters, so that's the big A, big B, and little b, and then we turn it on, and the monkey can control it just like this.
But basically, you sample the neural activity for a while, but the monkey can show the target on the screen.
Yep.
There's no cursor.
Yep. So there are different ways. Yeah. So there are different ways one could do this. So the way we do it is what you just described, which is the monkey passively observes cursor movements. Yeah?
So just show cursor hitting the target.
Yep. Okay. Yep. So this is a little surprising, right? Because we're recording in motor cortex, not in visual cortex. But yet, when the monkey passively observes cursor movements, we and other labs have seen modulation in the activity of motor cortex. So one reason for this might be that the monkey is highly trained at doing these cursor tasks, right? So even though it's not controlling the cursor, when it sees a cursor moving towards a target, it's thinking about pushing the cursor.
How do you know what you see is not just visual response to the target?
Well, it could be, but we're recording in the motor cortex, right? So visual responses. Yeah, I mean, there can be visual influences, but they're not super strong.
But then since it knows the mapping, since your model knows the mapping between the neurons and the cursor movements,
Yeah. So you can imagine designing a task where the animal is not getting visual feedback for a lot of, so you can blank out, say, the center of the screen. And then you can have the animal move the cursor out, and only when it gets out to the periphery does it actually see where the cursor is, and the monkey can still do that. So it's not as if like the operation of this relies on the monkey having, it's not that the visual feedback is driving the BCI. Yep.
And they never did the reaching out task with their arm or anything?
Right, right. You don't need that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. In fact, doing the arm reaching task at the beginning is not desirable for two reasons. One is that we don't want the animal to move their arm when they're doing a BCI. So it's a little, so it's tricky to train them not to move their arm in the first place. And so you don't want to mix arm movements and no arm movements in the same day. Right? And the second reason is that you want to train your parameters, A, big B, and little b, based on neural activity that looks as similar to the neural activity that you're going to observe during BCI control as possible. And the neural activity that we observe, that we record while the animal is passively observing these cursor movements are more similar to what we see during closed-loop BCI control than what we see when the animal's making overt arm movements. Yeah, Dave?
Typically, in these BMI tasks, you have a holdover period on the target, so you have to hold.
Yeah.
And I noticed you didn't show that. I'm just wondering if that...
Yeah, so in everything that I'm going to show today, there's no required hold time. All the animal needs to do is to hit the target at one time step.
So is it worth revisiting that question after you show the results, whether or not that's important?
Yeah. I guess it depends on what the goal is. So if the goal is to help, is to design a BCI for a person, then that's extremely important, right? If we want to grab a cup, we need to stop our arm when we get to the cup. Or if we want to use a mouse and, you know, get somewhere and click, right, we need to stop where the mouse goes. So it's extremely important. We can think about how important it is for the scientific questions that we study, that maybe we can revisit that afterwards. Yes. Yeah?
Can you use the same procedure for different cortical areas?
Yeah, that's an extremely interesting question. So this is a question I'm very interested in. And this is an active area. So most BCIs to date have been done in motor, premotor cortex, and parietal cortex. And also there's been one or two studies in the visual cortex, but pretty limited use of BCI outside of those areas so far. So.
Now, is there any reason to believe that it will work any different?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of really interesting scientific questions. And I think it comes down to whether or not one can volitionally modulate neural activity in the brain area that from which the neural activity is recorded.
But we know from biophysical experiments that
exactly.
Right.
So I think an interesting experiment is to compare, right, across different brain areas. What is the relative degree to which you can volitionally modulate your neural activity? Yeah, so maybe one qualitative difference that we see is that when the animal is making overt arm movements, the modulation in the firing rates of these neurons are larger than when the monkey is either passively observing cursor movements or moving a BCI cursor in closed loop.
And so you think that it's better for the training simply because of the similar order of magnitude?
I think it comes.
Suppose that instead we want to use that data in order to determine where the monkey moved when they actually moved. Right? So you want to use the low activity data So is that just because of the similarity of magnitude, or is it something inherent to the low magnitude data that makes it more useful to train, you know?
Right. So so I'm not sure I'm getting at this question, so let me know if I'm answering your question. So we can definitely do offline decoding, right, where the animal is making overt arm reaches, right, and then we record the neural activity and try to reconstruct the arm reaches from that neural activity, right? And you know, a lot of work has gone into that for over a decade, right? And we can do that reasonably well. The challenge here is to design a BCI that works well in closed loop, right? And we, as a field, realize that this is quite a different challenge than doing accurate offline reconstruction. Okay. So there are several key advantages for using a brain-computer interface relative to studying, say, eye or arm movements. Okay. So first is that with a BCI, we can monitor all of the neurons that directly drive movement, right, for the reason that I mentioned earlier. Okay. By the way in which we constructed the system, we get to record from the full set of control or output signals. Right? And this is going to be extremely powerful, right, because we're going to be able to make causal statements, right, about how if we see some change, right, in the behavior, in this case cursor behavior, we're going to be able to attribute that to some specific change in the neural activity that we recorded. Okay. The second advantage is that you, in a BCI, you can imagine, say, recording from 100 neurons, but only use 50 of them to drive the computer cursor, but then passively watch what the other 50 do. Right? And this is relevant to questions involving how brain areas communicate with each other, because brain areas don't have neurons that all project to other areas, but rather only a subset of the neurons project. Right? So there might be interesting experiments we can design along those lines. And thirdly, we can define a simple mapping, right, between neural activity and behavior, okay, like the one that I showed. Right? And this has advantages for being able to test specific hypotheses, okay, about what the brain is doing. Okay? I'm going to show examples of this. Okay? Fourthly, we can change the mapping on the fly during an experiment. Right? And this is going to allow us to study questions about learning. Okay? And then fifth, we can flexibly manipulate the proprioceptive feedback in the manner that I mentioned. Okay, so in the work that I'm going to be talking about today, we're going to leverage advantages 1, 3, and 4. Okay. So we're going to use a brain-computer interface to study learning. Okay? And learning, okay, presumably requires the brain to alter the neural activity patterns that it produces. Right? So whether it's learning to play tennis, right, or learning to manipulate a Rubik's Cube, right, something changes in your brain between when you're a novice, right, to when you become an expert. Okay, so the two key questions that we're going to try to address today, okay, are first, why are some tasks easier to learn than others? Okay, and then second, how does neural population activity change during learning? Okay, so let's dive into the first question. Okay, so why are some tasks easier to learn than others? Okay, perhaps the reason is that some neural activity patterns are easier for the brain to generate than others. Okay, we can go even farther to ask, can subjects learn to produce arbitrary population activity patterns? And if not, what defines the constraints on the set of patterns of activity that the brain is able to produce? Okay, so consider the following setup. Okay, so we're recording from a bunch of neurons. Okay, in this illustration, I'm just showing you three neurons so that I can draw this. Okay. We define a population activity space where each axis represents the level of activity of one neuron. Okay. So we can take a time bin, count the number of spikes produced by each neuron, and that defines a point in this space.
Byron?
Yes.
Can you go back one slide?
Yep. This one?
Yeah. If you consider all neurons in motor cortex as independent entities that then all can control, then I feel like these questions are very meaningful. But if you would consider say, if you would phrase this question for the spinal cord, where you have motor neurons, which are very hardwired downstream of, you know, premotor neurons, then, for example, the second question, can subjects learn to produce arbitrary population activity patterns? That becomes very, like, no, of course not, because they're hardwired.
Right.
You couldn't possibly produce arbitrary activity patterns.
Right.
So what makes you ask that question specifically about motor cortex? What makes you think that the neurons there might be so independent that this question is...
Yeah, I think you're asking a really great and interesting question, right? And the answer is we don't know, because... So what I would like to know is, of the neurons that we're recording from, right, are any of them cortical spinal neurons, right? And then we can ask whether there's a difference in the subject's ability to volitionally modulate the activity of the neurons that are cortical spinal versus the ones that are not. I think that would be a super interesting question. I think what you're suggesting is a really interesting direction in which to pursue.
Is there hope for doing post-hoc anatomical mapping of the tissue that you're recording from?
Yeah, so these animals are doing other tasks, right? So their lives are, you know, many, many years. So maybe eventually, right? But yeah, not easy. Okay, so we have this population activity space. Okay, for one time bin, we have a point in this space. Okay, we can take many non-overlapping bins, and that defines a cloud of points here. Okay, now we can define this BCI mapping, right? So remember, the BCI mapping is that equation that I showed on the third slide. Okay, and that's represented graphically here in one dimension. Okay, as this axis, okay, whereby if the animal produces neural activity here, that moves the cursor to the left. Whereas if the animal produces neural activity up here, then that moves the cursor to the right.
Can you just remind us this equation, this third slide?
Yeah, so that was xt equals some matrix A times xt minus 1. Right, where x is the velocity, right, of the cursor, plus matrix B times u of t, which is the neural activity, plus little b.
So what you said, like left and right, is the property of the matrix B, which
correct.
Whether you
yeah.
To the left.
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's related. It's related to that.
It's also related to A.
But it's not. Yeah, it's not that simple because we have that A matrix, right? So what the A?
What is it exactly? This direction?
It's the integral of x, right? Your position that you end up with in the workspace is the integral of x.
Yeah.
The position of the integral of the velocity.
Yeah. Yeah. So what we implemented was actually that equation.
Yeah. No, I'm asking. Yeah.
Yeah, so you can think about that as, so in this case, in what we actually implemented, it was a two-dimensional BCI. So the animal was moving the cursor on a screen. Okay. Here, for the sake of illustration, the BCI is only one-dimensional. Okay. So that it's going to be helpful for this drawing here. Okay. So imagine that equation, but now x has only one element instead of two.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Okay.
But this is a neuronal
space.
So this is a multi-dimensional space.
Yeah. Yep, great. So then the matrix B now becomes 1 by number of neurons.
So that's a vector. That is B.
And that is B, yeah.
So this is just B.
Yeah. Thanks.
That B dimension does not directly map onto the subject space because there's
correct.
The main matrix.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Okay. So the key experimental manipulation, okay, is to change this mapping unannounced to the animal. Okay, so right when we do this, the animal's performance will be poor. Okay, but through trial and error, the animal can learn to use this new mapping. Okay. So one thing that we noticed was that when we did this several times, there were some mappings that the animal could learn to use very well. Okay, but there were other mappings that the animal could not learn to use very well. Okay, and this led us to wonder why that was the case. Yeah?
Assuming that the animal can do the task very well, because you actually don't need the training in 2 minutes in the beginning?
No, what I mean, so that happened like at the beginning of the day. So that happens on every day. Okay, so what now I'm referring to is so the animal starts off the day with that 2 minutes of passive observation. Okay, and then it uses this first mapping, which we call the intuitive mapping, for a few hundred trials. Okay, and that it can control in the manner that you saw in the video, right? Which is 100% correct with about 1 second movement times. Okay, then unannounced to the animal, we switch the mapping. And then the animal's performance immediately goes down. And then we give the animal a few hundred trials to see if the animal can get better at using the second mapping. Yeah, there are you saying how do we choose what is the new mapping? Yeah, I'll talk about that in just a moment.
And the A is simply exponential relaxation.
Say again?
The matrix A is exponential relaxation.
Yeah, so the matrix A is close to the identity matrix, but its eigenvalues are typically smaller than 1, but close to 1. Exactly. Correct. Yeah. Okay. So we saw some mappings that the animal could learn to use. Okay, the second mapping. Whereas other changed mappings were difficult for the animal to use. Okay, and we asked why that was the case. Okay, and we wondered whether there was some general principle that could allow us to predict which ones would be easier to learn or harder to learn. Right. So if you give the animal a fixed budget of the number of trials, to what extent can it recover its original performance with the first mapping? Right. Okay. So our hypothesis was based on this empirical observation from our group and many other groups, okay, that the neural activity in this space does not uniformly populate this population activity space. Okay. Rather, this neural activity tends to lie near a low-dimensional space, okay, pictured in this cartoon using a plane. Okay. So we call this low-dimensional space the intrinsic manifold. Okay.
Is this spontaneous activity? You are talking about spontaneous activity now? Or what do you mean it tends to occupy this manifold?
Yeah, so you can do this for spontaneous activity. You can do this during a behavior. Right, so there are many groups who have looked at neural activity in this way, in different animals, different brain areas, different tasks. Right, and in almost all cases, you get neural activity that lies within some lower dimensional space within the population activity.
You talk about different behaviors, I get different behaviors to correspond to different models.
Correct, yeah.
So mm-hmm. Each model will then
you right, match. Right, right. Yeah. So the one that we used, yeah, right, was based on that 2 minutes of activity at the very beginning.
So when there was no movement, watching.
Correct.
Just watching.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nope. Yep. Okay. So what this intrinsic manifold represents is presumably something about the underlying circuit connectivity. Okay. So, for example, if neurons 1 and 2, okay, are connected to each other through an inhibitory connection, okay, then it might be that neurons 1 and 2, their activity anti-vary. Right, negatively covary. Okay, and that's captured here, right? And the slope being negative for neuron 1 versus neuron 2. Okay.
Right.
Yeah?
How much do you think this manifold depends on what you're describing right now, which is the network of neurons and their relationships that you're measuring?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, this is a great question, right? And I think this question is related to, you know, this question about, you know, different tasks, right? And also spontaneous activity. Absolutely, absolutely, right. So, yeah, so presumably there's an effect of different inputs onto the brain area to which we're recording, right? So in this case, right, in the case of our particular experiments, we define the intrinsic manifold based on these passive cursor, while the animal is passively observing these cursor movements.
Okay. So what if 1 and 2 are anti-correlated, for example, the reason you just gave us, and then input only appears on 1 but not 2? I guess that would just add noise to your manifold. It wouldn't create any additional correlations. See what I'm trying to get at? Like, what about this correlation-based description of the source of the manifold?
Mm-hmm. Right, 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 right. Okay, yeah. So I'm not saying that the intrinsic manifold comes only from the structure, right? So I guess all I'm saying is that the intrinsic manifold reflects some aspects of the underlying connectivity, right? In the sense that, you know, the reason why...
Those are your constraints.
Yeah, so the reason why the neural activity doesn't fully populate this activity space might be due to constraints imposed by the underlying connectivity of the circuit, as well as constraints on what inputs can be received, right, by this brain area. Okay, so our core hypothesis, okay, relies on this intrinsic manifold. Okay, so what we hypothesized, okay, was that if we take this black mapping, okay, which is mapping 1, right, this intuitive mapping that the animal can control very well. And then we switch the mapping to this red 1, okay, which lies still within the intrinsic manifold. Okay, we predict that this is going to be easier for the animal to learn. Okay, whereas if we switch the mapping from the black to the blue, okay, where the blue is now outside of the intrinsic manifold, then we predict that this is going to be harder for the animal to learn. Sorry?
What matters is the projection on B, so in your equation. So I'm not sure I understand the why it's so different. I mean, because what matters is only the component. If you project on B, it's just the component within the manifold.
Well, let's say it's perpendicular.
In his case, it's a 100-dimensional
exactly
vector,
exactly.
So every so most of the space is a
five. Yeah, yeah. So
dimensions are
yeah, yeah. So in this illustration, We have three neurons in the cartoon, a two-dimensional intrinsic manifold, and a one-dimensional BCI mapping. Okay? In the actual experiments, we had around 90 neural units. We had a 10-dimensional intrinsic manifold and a two-dimensional BCI mapping.
What do you think that you had 10-dimensional intrinsic manifold?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So we asked the data, right? So we used standard methods for cross-validation to assess how many dimensions are needed to explain the shared variability among the neural units in the data that we recorded at the beginning of the day, right? And so you can assess that for each day. We built a distribution of those dimensionalities, and the mean and the peak of that distribution is at 10. Yeah?
So you plan to separate the front to learn the manifold over, let's say, 9 neurons from 2 minutes. That's a very, very small training set for 5 minutes.
Right, right. Yep, great. Yeah. So we've assessed this question using, so in a context, not exactly this one, but we've addressed that question in visual cortex and in the context of spiking network models. Okay, and the what we found, okay, was that as you increase the amount of data, so meaning number of trials, right, that the number of dimensions that you recover can increase. Okay, so almost assuredly, what you're saying is true, right? Which is that with 2 minutes of data, that's not enough to recover all the dimensions that could be recovered had we recorded for hours and hours. Okay, but the dimensions that are identified using the smallish number of trials, they already capture very well those dimensions that have lots of shared variance, meaning that the additional dimensions that are identified by recording for more and more trials, those are typically ones that are harder to see and have less shared variance. So I think, okay, that's sort of part one of the response. Okay, part two of the response is, you know, maybe what you're asking, tell me if this is the case, right, is that we're only defining this intrinsic manifold while the animal is engaging in a very, very limited behavior, right? So ideally, what we would want is for the animal to be running around in the wild for a year, right? And us to record neural activity from these neurons around the clock, right? And then using that neural activity, we want to define the intrinsic manifold, right? Because that would presumably better reflect what this population of neurons is capable of producing. Right? So almost certainly, the intrinsic manifold that we estimated during this experiment is smaller than that fuller intrinsic manifold. Okay, so we can think through what would be the consequences of that on our ability to address this scientific question. Okay, so that would mean that certain outside, what we think are outside manifold mappings would actually be within manifold. Within this larger one, right? And so if that were the case, that would make any effects harder to see, right? Because we'd be basically saying, we'd be mixing, right? What we think is an outside manifold mapping is actually within manifold mapping, right? And so that would make the difference in the animal's ability to learn between the red and the blue, right, to be smaller. So because of that, in hindsight, I'm quite surprised that we were actually able to see a difference between the red and the blue, okay, which I haven't described yet, but yeah. Which to me indicates how strong this effect might be, right, if we were able to identify this full intrinsic manifold. Yeah.
Do you also adjust your small b, the bias model, so that the activity pattern in the original mapping corresponds to zero velocity
So what we do is we first z-score the activity of all the units. Okay, so now they're all centered at 0. Okay, yeah, and then they all have variance 1.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think.
Changing capital B is sufficient to keep the.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's not perfect, right? In some cases, when we switch the mapping, there is a bias, right? And the animal's challenge will be to correct for that bias. That's part of sort of the learning involved, too. Yeah. Yep?
Should we be taking the planar subspace here seriously? Or are you looking at linear subspaces, or are you looking at some like local linear embedding or something?
Right. So everything that I'm going to be talking about today relies on a linear intrinsic manifold. I think it's very interesting to think about how we might move towards nonlinear spaces. It's, you know, as you and you know everyone here probably knows, you know, this identifying nonlinear manifolds, you know, has been a major pursuit in machine learning and statistics, you know, in the last 20 years or so, and it's proven very challenging. Right, so you know, lots of nonlinear dimensionality reduction methods have been developed and have been shown to work well in sort of certain scenarios. Right, typically ones with very little to no noise. Right, and oftentimes, you know, you need to seed these algorithms with something close to the right answer for it to get to the right answer. Okay, so, and we know that neural activity here. That you know that we're taking on single trials is quite noisy, right? And so it'd be interesting to think through, you know, which, if any, of the current nonlinear dimensionality reduction methods would be appropriate with single trial neural activity, and if not, how can we improve on those methods to do better? Okay, so here's our central hypothesis, right? That these within-manifold BCI mappings are easier to learn than these outside-manifold BCI mappings. Okay. So one thing you might be thinking to yourself is, why are you even testing this? Like, isn't this obvious? Right? Why are you wasting your time? Okay. So let me put two things on the table. Okay. The first thing is that other studies that have come before us have changed the BCI mappings in ways that are akin to these outside manifold mappings. Okay? And they found that animals could learn to use those. Right? So it's not as if like these mappings are impossible to learn to use. Okay? And then the second thing to put on the table, okay, is that right after we switched the mapping, it's not as if these mappings are super difficult and these are super easy. Right? Rather, what we want is a scenario where right after we switch the mapping, we have equal difficulty in the red and the blue. Right? And then from that point, we want to see the animal's ability to learn.
I'm not sure you say V once, but I don't really understand what is it that you want to do.
Yeah.
I understand your question and I understand that it may sound obvious that
Yeah.
Ah,
it's because, okay, so we as experimenters, we get to choose what the red mapping and the blue mappings are. Right? So I can choose a red mapping that makes it really, really difficult for the animal right after I switch the mapping. Or I can choose a red one that's really, really easy for the animal right after I switch
the
mapping. Right.
Okay.
Right. So there's, right. So we have, the ability to choose here, okay, and so all I'm saying is that we want to choose these perturbed mappings such that the initial difficulty right after we switch the mapping is equally difficult in the blue in the red case as in the blue case.
What's initial difficulty?
Yeah. So let's say you take the first 20 trials.
You mean the initial performance?
Exactly. Yeah.
The initial performance to be at the same level.
Exactly.
Same red level, right? If you want this new mapping,
correct. Be not yeah. immediately. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Good. Yeah, yeah.
And the cases before when you did outside manifold mapping, if they were able to do that, did the manifold actually change or did it remain outside of the manifold?
Yeah. So in these experiments, when we tried to, so we took the neural activity post-learning, right, and tried and asked whether we could see a difference in the intrinsic manifold measured post-learning versus pre-learning. And we were not able to see a difference. Okay? And we did some simulations to assess how large the change in the manifold needed to be for us to be able to see it, given the noise levels in the data. And it turns out that you need a pretty big change to be able to see it. Okay, so the fact that we weren't able to see it may or may not mean that there wasn't a change. Okay. However, what we've done since the study is to have the animal use these outside manifold mappings for multiple days, okay, up to 2 weeks. And in those experiments, what we've seen is the animal is able to produce activity outside the manifold.
In other words, it actually changes the manifold.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It's not
yeah.
outside by definition.
Yeah, yep. Okay. All right. So we've already touched on some of these things from the questions. Okay. So let me tell you specifically how we switch the mappings. Okay. So the typical way to map neural activity to cursor movements is using a common filter. Okay. This is what most people in the field use. Okay. So as I mentioned, neural activity is 90 dimensional. So 90 neural units. And then out comes a two-dimensional cursor velocity. Okay, so what we did here, okay, was to introduce factor analysis, okay, at the beginning here to pre-process the neural activity. Okay, and what factor analysis does is it converts the 90-dimensional neural activity into 10-dimensional activity, which is activity within the 10-dimensional intrinsic manifold. Okay. And those 10 so-called factors, okay, are then passed into the common filter, which then produces the cursor velocity. And the reason why we introduced factor analysis was to be able to dissociate between these two types of perturbed mappings. Okay. So for this within manifold perturbation, okay, what we did was we took the 10 factors, okay, and we permuted them. Okay? So what that does is it preserves the relationship, okay, between the neural activity and the factors, but it changes the relationship between the factors and the cursor velocity.
But can you say you permute them, these factors of similar importance? Or?
Yeah. So what we did was to z-score each of these factors, okay, and the reason why we wanted to do that, okay, was because we don't want to ask whether neurons are able to show activity outside their physiological range, right? Instead, what we're trying to test here is whether neurons can show sort of different correlation patterns than they naturally show, right? So we tried to do the best we could to equalize the importance, as you say, right, of these factors before we permuted them.
So the covariance in the intrinsic manifold is what? It's just the identity, proportional to the identity? Or is the identity after what?
The marginal variance in each dimension is one. But the factors can be correlated with each other.
The factors, okay, so you're not yeah. making independent dimensions here.
Correct. Right. But the variance along each dimension is one.
So then it goes back to the question again, because you might say, okay, well, along each marginal direction, which need not matter, might be the same, but there's a high variance dimension and a low variance dimension in the intrinsic manifold.
Mm-hmm. So while still satisfying.
You permute those two, but okay, you're just permuting marginals. You're not allowing a generic rotation.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for the outer manifold perturbations, what we did was we permuted the neural units, okay, the 90-dimensional vector. Okay, and what this does is it changes the relationship between the units, okay, and each of the factors, okay, but keeps the relationship between the factors and the cursor velocity the same. Okay. Yeah.
Can you remind me of the constraints you put on selecting those 19 neurons? Because if you have some bad ones in there, then that would automatically make it harder, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So what we did was, okay, so there are 96 electrodes, right, on this Utah array. Okay, so in a given day, we turn off all the units that don't look like they have anything with neural origin. Okay, and on a typical day, we were left with then 90 units. And we used all 90 of those units for this. Yeah, I mean, we can think some more about how, like, if a unit happened to be noisier than another, what its implications would be on.
Because then initially it wouldn't be weighted very, very, very strongly in the factor analysis, right? But after you permute the neurons, then it might be weighted more strongly than.
I'm not sure I understand.
The factor analysis is trained. It's trained, right?
On the neural basis. Yep.
So if you have a neuron without any inputs that's just randomly spiking, that will not be part of the factor analysis model initially.
Right. So what factor analysis is trying to identify?
Sure. Yeah. But then you permute them, that neuron will suddenly be taken into account by the factor analysis based model.
Yeah. Yeah. So we don't. So after this initial step, where we exclude any units that don't look like they have anything of neural origin, we keep all the remaining units and continue using them throughout the experiment. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you apply an independent measure to the nature of those neurons, do they come out as similarly tuned to movements or?
Which ones?
The 90 electrodes.
Yeah. So sorry, what's similarly tuned to what?
Again, going by the spinal cord analogy,
you
have some sensory neurons in there by accident.
Mm-hmm.
They will be removed by the factor analysis model.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say they would be removed?
Because they're not. The factor analysis models fit purely on the spontaneous data.
During passive observation. All right, so as I mentioned, these are UTAR array recordings in motor cortex of macaque monkeys. We used threshold crossings, okay, so there was no further spike sorting right after we eliminated those non-neural electrodes. Spike counts were taken in non-overlapping 45 millisecond bins, okay, and we used an 8 target center out task. Okay. So here's the performance, okay, of the animal on a representative session, okay, for one of these within manifold perturbations. So on the vertical axis here is the animal success rate, and the horizontal axis here is the trial number. Okay, so at the beginning of the day, the animal uses this intuitive mapping and can control it with typically 100% correct, okay, as you saw in the video. Okay. And then unannounced to the animal, we switch the mapping. Okay, that's this dotted line. Okay, and as you would expect, the animal's performance goes down. Okay, and then through trial and error, the animal can learn to use this new mapping and recover performance, in this case, nearly to the same level as it was before.
It's not clear from the case. It goes to zero or it goes to somewhere around 50. I'm not sure if the red line starts from zero.
Yeah, it's a little tricky to compute, right? So right after this dotted line, okay, we want to, so success rate, right, on any given trial, it's either successful or failed, right? So on any given trial, it's zero or one. So to compute this curve, we need to average across trials, okay? But we don't want that average to bleed across that boundary, okay? So at the very beginning, there's one trial, and then there's two trials, and we average across those, and then there's three trials, and we average across those, until we have... Yeah, so I think this is averaged over 20, moving window of 20 trials. But at the very beginning,
exactly.
So it's a little tricky to compute.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, we could. Okay, and then after a few hundred trials, we then give the animal this first mapping back to it. And then sometimes we would see a decrement in performance, and then the animal would sort of get back.
This means that the first trial will always fail.
Right here?
Yeah. The first new trial after you change the...
Yeah. So...
Always fails?
Not always.
Not always. So why does it begin from zero? This is not average.
This is just one session, so it's not average.
Session.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So in this session, it failed.
Yeah. Right, but it doesn't... Yeah, that's what it looks like.
So yeah. The monkey actually learned after one failed trial immediately.
Yeah, well. Yeah, and each trial...
Well, it's a two-dimensional...
Yeah, so on each trial, the animal has 7.5 seconds to try to get to the target. So even within the first trial, like maybe during the first 3 seconds, the animal's trying to move the cursor and it's not going to where it wants it to go. But it can still try to correct itself within that trial and still get it correct. So it's possible, right, that even on the very first trial, the animal could get it correct. Okay, so we measured not only success rate, but also acquisition time, right? And so in those cases, acquisition time is very informative because on that first trial, if the animal sort of went off in the wrong direction first and then corrected and got it correct, we wouldn't be able to see it in this success rate, right? But we would be able to see it in acquisition time, right? So on those trials, acquisition times will be very long, and then later on during learning, acquisition times will be shorter because the cursor trajectories would be more direct.
So maybe the better way would be just to give it a long time and just measure how long to...
Yeah, so that's why we measured acquisition time as well.
Yeah.
But here I'm just showing success rate for simplicity. Okay, so we contrast that with an example outside manifold perturbation session, okay, where here, again, at the beginning, the animal's performance is very good with the first mapping, okay, and then when we introduce the perturbed mapping, the animal's performance goes down, okay, and you notice here that for this particular perturbation, the performance didn't go down as far as with this perturbation, okay, and then during this session, the animal did not show much learning, right? It went up a little, and then it went back down.
But what was the perturbation?
Yeah, so in this case, right, this one was this one, right? This outside manifold perturbation where we...
What is the, what kind of, I mean, I understand that
yeah.
Change the vector.
Yeah.
In one case, it changed the dimensional vector. In another case, it changed the nine-dimensional vector.
Mm-hmm. So what is the?
How do you change the vector?
Permute the elements within the vector of neural activity. So it's a 90 by 1 vector, and we permuted them.
But like, I might object. For example, your projection of that 90-dimensional vector on the 10-dimensional manifold turn to zero because you essentially
rotate
the
90-dimensional
vector.
Yep. Perfect. Yeah. This is great.
No projection on 10-dimensional relevant manifold.
Yep. So
you're just deteriorating
Yeah. So you're asking a really important question, okay? So what you're saying is true, okay? That if we had chosen any arbitrary perturbation, any arbitrary permutation here, right, that the effect on the cursor would be now the animal moves the neural activity around and the cursor doesn't move. Okay, so this is why we couldn't choose any arbitrary permutation, but rather we had to choose a permutation very carefully. Okay, so the way in which we did this, okay, was we enumerated several million possible permutations during the experiment. Okay, and for each of those, we predicted how difficult it would be for the animal. Okay, and the way in which we did that was we took the neural activity that the animal showed using the intuitive mapping, and we passed that through the candidate perturbed mapping. Okay, so what that does is we can say, okay, if the animal kept producing the neural activity that it normally produces for that target, where would the cursor go? Okay, and that would allowed us to assess how difficult initially this perturbed mapping would be. Okay, and our goal was to choose a perturbed mapping that was neither too difficult nor too easy. Okay, so the reason why we don't want to choose one that's too easy is because then there's nothing to learn. Okay, and we don't want to choose one that's too hard, like the one that you described, where the cursor doesn't go anywhere, because the animal will just give up and we can't do the experiment. So we had to choose one that had intermediate difficulty. Okay, so we defined some criterion, and for each of the several million possible permutations that we enumerated, we gave each one a score. Okay, and then we said, okay, only candidate permutations that have a score within a certain range would we keep or consider to use.
But to apply the same procedure to the red permutation?
Yep, exactly.
I think it's a related question, but so here you show two different, you take two examples of two mappings, and then you show performance.
Mm-hmm.
But to generalize the conclusion, mm-hmm. and be sure that it has to do with this intrinsic manifold,
yep.
shouldn't you choose many blue examples, many
yep.
red examples?
That's exactly what we did.
Yeah, but you showed only the performance for two of them.
Uh-huh.
So one would have to see the kind of average over these two ensembles.
If we or
correct.
Get to the next slide, we might
No, actually, I don't have, I mean, I'm not, I'm not showing that histogram, but yes, you're exactly right, right? So we can't just look at those two sessions and make a conclusion, right?
Like, do you know, like as a function of the distance with the manifold or like, you know, some...
Right. So, yeah. So you're making a really important point, right? Which is that when comparing these, we have to make sure that certain aspects are controlled for, okay? So one aspect that we had to control for was this thing that you're mentioning here, okay? Which is that the amount of rotation, right, of the mapping is not different between the red and the blue. Okay, that's one thing we had to control for. Another thing we had to control for is that the initial difficulty, right after we switched the mapping, had to be matched between red and blue.
But the
okay.
difficulty is not very meaningful.
It is. It's extremely important, right? Because we want to assess the animal's ability to learn in each case. So we need, okay, so if it were the case.
No, I'm saying
right,
you base
yeah.
your initial difficulty on one trial.
No, no. So it's based on, I think, the first 20 trials.
Ah, so can you show which point it is on the curve?
Yeah, so I guess here 50 trials is like half of one of these. Is that right? Or a quarter of one of these tick marks, right? So it's just the few trials at the beginning here. Right? So you can build. Okay, so what we did was across two animals, we conducted tens of sessions for each of these two types in each of two animals. Mm-hmm. Okay? For each of these sessions, right, you can compute what is the initial difficulty based on the first 20 trials.
These are two different animals?
No, these two came from the same animal. Right?
Okay.
But we replicated it in two animals.
Okay.
Okay, so what we need to ensure was that the distribution of initial difficulties was not different in red versus blue. Okay, and then another thing we needed to ensure is that the required changes in the preferred directions of each of the neurons in red versus blue was not different. Okay. So, long story short, right, we saw a difference in the animal's ability to learn in these two cases. Okay? Namely, that we saw greater learning within the manifold, okay, than we did outside the manifold. Okay. Okay. So what this implies? Okay. Yeah.
I'm curious about the background because I read the paper and the methods.
Yep.
The methods suggest that it took a lot of effort to you know, some of these things you said, like the test of running these millions of permutations and picking out the reasonable ones and so on. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you guys established at the start, or did that come after doing some experiments and figuring out that it wasn't, you know, something was unfairly going wrong, so you fixed it? How was the iterative process behind this whole project?
Yeah, so we did that enumeration procedure from essentially the very beginning because we're faced with all these possibilities of how to perturb the mapping. And it's clear from one or two experiments, right, that if you don't perturb it correctly, that you can run into a situation where right after you perturb the mapping, the cursor doesn't move anymore, right, because of the reason that was just mentioned. So then we started, you know, doing this prediction procedure, essentially at the very beginning of Animal 1.
And how long did the whole experimental part of the project last? Since you said that you could train a monkey in 2 minutes, and
Right. So there were tens of sessions, right, of each type in each animal, right? So that, like, there was a lot of work training the animal before we started data collection for this project, right? Yeah, so several months, 3 to 4, and then that's for one animal, and then again for another animal. Okay, so what this implies, okay, is that the underlying circuitry, right, for a bunch of neurons, influences, okay, what is easy for this population of neurons to do, and what is more difficult, what types of activity patterns are more difficult for this population of of these neurons to produce. Okay, so it appears as if, right, the structure, right, of a neural circuit influences what's easy for the animal to learn and what's difficult for the animals to learn. Okay, furthermore, you know, people often ask, you know, is dimensionality reduction good for anything more than creating pretty pictures? Okay, and I think this is one example in which we've put dimensionality reduction in a closed loop experiment, okay, to show, to ask, what are the causal constraints, right, on what an animal can learn to do, right? So I think this is more than pretty pictures. Okay. Any questions before we shift gears to part two? Yeah.
I'm still thinking about the choice of dimensionality reduction. So
yep.
PCA, so why do you use PCA as opposed to like a linear determinant type of analysis? Right? I'm thinking of a case in which you can have a dimension that has very high variance. Mm-hmm. So it would be the first thing that PCA would go after.
Mm-hmm. Factor analysis, but yeah.
Yeah. Whatever.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
So it's the first thing they would go after, but it could have nothing to do with the movement of the cursor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
So it seems like you could, in principle, find a much more relevant linear subspace.
Mm-hmm.
And
so.
In fact, that's likely given some of the results about these huge loop signals that have lots of.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so what's important here is that we didn't consider only the top few factors, right? So we ask the data how many factors can be reliably identified in these data, right? And the answer was 10. Okay, so if we were to have, say, kept only the top two dimensions, okay, then what you're saying is almost certainly true, which is that those top two dimensions that explain the most shared variance are not the ones in which we would get the best discriminability or the best decoding, right? But within the top,
other options. So you know, if you could get away with four really relevant factors using some other algorithm,
right?
Still
yeah,
in
yeah,
space,
yeah, yeah.
Just work better.
How would you define relevance when you're just looking at an intrinsic manifold without a drive or a
Well, so the suggestion here is to do something, you know, something more like a linear discriminant analysis,
mm-hmm.
but bigger space instead of a
But that requires something that you're trying to discriminate.
And we know what it is. We're trying
but
to discriminate the graph evolution of the cursor.
But he's changing the matrix. So how would you define in a mapping independent way that allows you to flexibly change the mapping which one you want to discriminate?
All of the 2D movements on the screen.
Right. Right. So I'm just trying to understand like where what the goal is. Is the goal to obtain
the most relevant linear subspace as opposed to the one that explains the greatest variance in the spike
right.
in the markets?
Right. So do you want is this an engineering goal of creating like a cursor that the subject can control extremely well? Or is the goal of addressing this scientific question or a different scientific question?
I guess I'm hoping to get more sensitivity on your scientific question by having a better linear subspace.
Right. So we didn't try exactly what you suggested, but we've tried other things that are similar in flavor. And among these various methods, you get performance that is very similar. And so I don't think so. We could try exactly what you did, but my guess would be that it would not do substantially better than what you're seeing here. But we could test it. Yeah. Yeah. And one other thing to also keep in mind is that one thing we've realized as a field is that offline decoding performance is not always indicative of online closed-loop decoding performance. And the reason for this is because the animal can compensate here in these closed-loop experiments.
I mean, I guess what I'm thinking is if you find yourself in a different brain area where there's more mixed signals,
mm-hmm.
right, some premotor area or posterior parietal cortex area, then this could fail because the dimensions that have the greatest variance might not be the ones that are most relevant for controlling movement.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other pretty similar things. That
right, sure. Yeah, it depends on, exactly, it depends on the properties of the activity in that brain area, right? So empirically what we see here is that if you order the dimensions based on the amount of shared variance, that the ones that are most needed for decoding here, the cursor, is contained within the first five. It's usually not exactly the first two, but it's within the first five. Okay? And here we're including 10. So I would say with confidence that in all experiments, we've kept all the important ones for decoding here.
Are the first two lower ever, or are they usually still pretty high weight, but you need more?
Like, what do you mean lower?
Are they really noise? Like, are they just collective noise?
The top two?
The top two. Are they never useful and you have to go to three to get something useful? Which is
that is rare. Usually the
first three.
It's usually highly overlapping with the first three to four. Yeah.
So like the first dimension and sometimes part of the second is what's called a condition independent loop. So it's this enormous signal.
For on control. Yeah.
I think to really compete successfully with the quantum physicists, we should take a break and eat their cookies now. And then afterwards, either come back and finish your talk and then go on to starting ones, right? Is that the schedule? Or the reverse order? How much more time do you need to finish the slides? Quite a long time, right?
Yeah, I mean, if I go straight, maybe 15 to 20 minutes. But
we take a 10-minute break and then finish Byron's slides and then.
Or I'm okay with switching to Xiaojing.
Yeah.
Either way is fine with me.
Yeah, let me finish.
Yeah.